Hey, this is John Lee Dumas from EO Fire, and you're listening to Elective Rotation with Pharmacy Joe. You must be prepared to ignite.
What's up, Pharmacy Nation? I'm Pharmacy Joe. Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care pharmacy podcast. This is episode 26, a review of the 2015 Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation Guidelines. I have all the evidence supporting today's show linked up in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode26. The American Heart Association Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation Guidelines have been updated for 2015. There are some interesting changes to the guidelines that pharmacists should know about, and I'll summarize them for you in this episode. I strongly recommend that any pharmacist who is involved in responding to medical emergencies read at least sections 7, 8, 9, and 10 of these new guidelines. The first thing I'll talk about is the web-based guidelines with continuous updates. The guidelines will transition from a 5-year cycle of periodic revisions and updates to a web-based format that is continuously updated. The first release of the web-based integrated guidelines, now available at eccguidelines.heart.org, is based on the comprehensive 2010 guidelines plus the 2015 guidelines update. Moving forward, these guidelines will be updated by using a continuous evidence evaluation process to facilitate more rapid translation of new scientific discoveries into daily patient care. This is certainly an exciting change, and I hope other organizations that put out guidelines take note and do the same. As far as evidence evaluation goes, the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation adopted the GRADE process, or Grading of Recommendations, Assessment, Development, and Evaluation, for their evidence evaluation. The GRADE process, which I have linked to in the show notes, is used in other excellent guidelines, such as the 2012 ACCP antithrombotic guidelines published in CHESS. The evidence levels in this updated guidelines are as such. There are 315 classified recommendations. 25% are class 1, 68% are class 2, and 7% are class 3 recommendations. Overall, 1% of the recommendations are based on level of evidence of A, 15% are based on level of evidence B with randomized studies, 15% are based on level of evidence B, non-randomized studies. 46% are based on level of evidence C, which is limited data, and 23% are based on level of evidence C, expert opinion. It's important to know the level of evidence behind each guideline recommendation before deciding on whether to apply the recommendation to your patient. I think it's fascinating that the majority of the recommendations in these guidelines are level 2 or lower and are based on either limited data or consensus opinion. There's been an upper limit placed on the rate of compressions. The new guidelines say, in adult victims of cardiac arrest, it is reasonable for rescuers to perform chest compressions at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. The addition of an upper limit of compression rate is the result of one large registry study associating extremely rapid compression rates with inadequate compression depth. I have yet to give chest compressions in a code, and I hope to keep it that way. There are always so many other people that respond. But you can be sure that this upper limit of compression rate will be in any recertification course you take. There is a mention in the new guidelines of giving epinephrine sooner in some cases. The new guidelines say the recommendation for timing of epinephrine administration were updated and stratified based on the initial presenting rhythm, recognizing the potential difference in pathophysiologic disease. For those with a non-shockable rhythm, that would be PEA, it may be reasonable to administer epinephrine as soon as feasible. This appears to be building common sense into the guidelines, and that's always a good thing. Now, vasopressin, it's gone, or is it? Vasopressin was removed from the ACLS cardiac arrest algorithm as a vasopressor therapy in recognition of equivalence of effect with other available interventions. That would be epinephrine. This modification valued the simplicity of approach toward cardiac arrest when two therapies were found to be equivalent. With the recent price increase of vasopressin, this is a very interesting change. Nothing has changed in terms of evidence to support vasopressin use. It was removed purely to keep the algorithm simple. Very rarely is vasopressin requested at my institution to replace the first dose of epinephrine, and I do not recommend it. I estimate we have about $25,000 worth of vasopressin stocked in our code carts throughout my institution. This change in the guidelines should help free up some of the drug budget to spend on something more effective. Now, vasopressin wasn't completely removed from the guidelines, as there is also a level of evidence C recommendation to consider vasopressin use. So the guidelines state the combination of intra-arrest vasopressin, epinephrine, and methylprednisolone and post-arrest hydrocortisone may be considered. However, further studies are needed before the routine use of this therapeutic strategy can be recommended. Now, where did this come from? A pair of studies were published in 2009 and 2013. I have them linked in the show notes. They were looking at vasopressin plus epinephrine plus methylprednisolone versus epinephrine plus placebo given in cardiac arrest. Both studies had positive outcomes, and the second found significantly improved survival to discharge with good neurologic outcome compared with only epinephrine and placebo. I found it puzzling. With two randomized controlled trials, albeit most of the patients in the 2013 study were at the same center as the 2009 one, why is this recommendation so weak and buried in the update? So I emailed the lead author of the studies, Dr. Spiros D. Mentzelopoulos, to ask his opinion. I got a response within 8 hours. It never fails. Every time I email a study author, each article has a correspondence email listed, I get a prompt response. I got this idea from my wife. Shout out to my wife, who is an elementary reading teacher. She will have her students write the author of a book, and they always write back. Corresponding with authors of studies is so educational and effective, I call it pharmacyjoism number 18. For questions about green eggs and ham, email Dr. Seuss. Now, I'm going to read my email to Dr. Spiros D. Mentzelopoulos and my response. I hope I'm pronouncing that, by the way. I'm really counting on Stavroula and Diamantis. I know they're listening in Greece right now. I'm really counting on them to correct my pronunciation. So please, please do so if I got that name wrong. So my email to the lead author of the study. I read your studies with great interest when they were published. I'm surprised, given that you have two randomized controlled trials supporting giving vasopressin plus epinephrine plus methylprednisolone, that the updated ACLS guidelines do not include this as a stronger recommendation. Why do you think this is? Do you use the combination of medications in your study routinely in your hospital? Thank you for your great work, Joe. And here's the response that I received just 8 hours later. Thank you so much for your interest and positive comments on our work. Regarding critical long-term outcomes, the first randomized clinical trial had favorable results on survival to hospital discharge, and the second RCT had favorable results on survival to hospital discharge with good neurologic recovery. These critical outcomes do not coincide, that is, they are not the same. Survival to discharge does not necessarily mean leaving the hospital at a good functional status. Consequently, there has actually been one small favorable RCT showing better survival to discharge and one larger favorable RCT showing better survival to discharge with good neurologic outcome. These studies have been conducted within the Greek National Health System, and the generalizability of the results to other national health systems still remains to be shown. An important difference among NHSs across the world pertains to the efficacy of infection control measures, especially in the intensive care environment. More generally speaking, it is widely acceptable that differences in the quality of care, including post-resuscitation care, can potentially impact patient outcomes. In addition, it should be noted that several critical care interventions such as activated protein C, tight glucose control with insulin, and early goal-directed therapy, initially supported by substantially larger studies, were not subsequently validated by follow-up in multi-center multinational trials. Therefore, I would say that the AHA recommendation regarding the results of our studies is both fair and prudent. I would strongly support the conduct of a definitive multinational study on the vasopressin, steroids, epinephrine, or VSE combination. Of course, I would expect and predict positive results. In our hospital, we do apply the VSE protocol. Nevertheless, lately we have been facing a shortage in vasopressin supply secondary to the economic crisis-related capital controls. Even so, intensivists most frequently choose to prescribe stress-dose hydrocortisone for post-resuscitation shock. Thank you again for your interest. Okay, the next part of the guidelines is an update to the target for temperature management. A high-quality randomized controlled trial did not identify any superiority of targeted temperature management at 36 degrees Celsius compared with management at 33 degrees Celsius. Excellent outcomes are possible when patients are actively managed at either temperature. All comatose adult patients with return of spontaneous circulation after cardiac arrest should have targeted temperature management, with providers selecting and maintaining a constant temperature between 32 and 36 degrees Celsius for at least 24 hours after achieving target temperature. It is also reasonable to actively prevent fever in comatose patients after targeted temperature management. I'll have to check with my cardiologist on this to see if we will change our temperature range. I believe we are still aiming for 33 degrees Celsius at my institution. Naloxone was added to the list of basic life support interventions. And the new guidelines state, for patients with known or suspected opioid addiction who have a definite pulse but no normal breathing or only gasping, in addition to providing standard BLS care, it is reasonable for appropriately trained BLS providers to administer IM or intranasal naloxone. It is reasonable to provide opioid overdose response education with or without naloxone distribution to persons at risk for opioid overdose in any setting. Now, naloxone in this context refers to use outside of the hospital, where BLS measures would be deployed first. For naloxone dosing in the hospital, listen to my last episode, episode 25, which you can find at pharmacyjoe.com/episode25. And last, intravenous lipid emulsion makes the cut into these guidelines. Administration of IV lipids for the treatment of local anesthetic systemic toxicity, or LAST, particularly from bupivacaine, is supported by extensive animal research and human case reports. In the 2015 guidelines update, this science was reviewed, and a weak recommendation supporting the use of IV lipids for treatment of LAST was reaffirmed. Since 2010, animal studies and human case reports have been published that examined the use of IV lipids for patients with other forms of drug toxicity with mixed results. The 2015 guidelines update contains a new recommendation that IV lipids may be considered in patients with cardiac arrest due to drug toxicity other than LAST who are failing standard resuscitative measures. Now, IV lipid emulsion definitely deserves to be a podcast topic on its own. I'm glad to see this new recommendation make it into the guidelines. An emergency medicine physician I worked with showed me a successful case study about IV lipid emulsion and overdose many years ago. As a result, I had IV lipids placed in the automated dispensing cabinets in all the critical care and surgical areas of my hospital. Wouldn't you know it? On my day off, there was a cardiac arrest in the pre-op area 40 minutes after a ropivacaine nerve block was administered. The patient had VTAC, resistant to multiple shocks and amiodarone. IV lipids were given, and within 1 minute, the patient had return of spontaneous circulation. They were later discharged neurologically intact. That's it for my review of the guidelines. There are many more changes, which you can find in the links that I've provided in the show notes to the original guidelines. If you know someone who would find this episode helpful, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.